Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm well.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
It is Labor Day weekend, which means summer is drawing to a close, and the summer movie season along with it. Exhibitors celebrated the complete and utter lack of new product with a $3 movie day on Saturday, which had the intended effect of boosting weekend-to-weekend numbers for the year's biggest hits. Pictures like Top Gun, Maverick, Bullet Train, League of Super Pets, Minions, Rise of Gru, they all saw weekend-to-weekend gains, right? And it boosted the returns of re-releases like Spider-Man No Way Home and Jaws. Sure, it was the worst weekend of the summer and really very bad just in terms of pure overall gross.
At least one report I saw said that last weekend was actually, the previous weekend was the worst, but it's like a $500,000 difference.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. But the point is, theater owners made the best of a bad situation, and the gimmick seemed to have worked. It did actually boost the numbers, you know, quite a bit. The overall number of admissions higher, whatever. They made it work. Was the summer a bad situation all around? It's kind of the question we're asking ourselves. It's hard to say exactly. On the one hand, box office is up 150% year over year from last year, right? That's not bad. On the other hand, it's still 32% lower than 2019, the last pre-pandemic year. And a 32% decline might represent the new normal, which would, yes, be bad. Or it might just be an artifact of the fact that there are 30% fewer wide releases on 3,000 plus screens so far this year, right? Or maybe that lower number of new releases is, in fact, the new normal, which, again, would be bad. All right, one thing that's obvious, the box office is even top heavier than usual, right? Top Gun Maverick was basically two blockbusters in one with its $700 million gross, which is to say that it is the equal of the gross of the two biggest titles still in release, right? Minions Rise of Gru and Thor Love and Thunder, which have totaled about $700 million between them. And while there have been some pleasant surprises, right? Elvis grossing $150 million, huge surprise to me. I'm shocked by that. I figured this would be, looking at the ads, I thought this would be an enormous bomb, turned out to be a pretty big hit. Or The Black Phone legging out to nearly $100 million domestic. That mid-range film, that mid-range success has been sorely lacking. Bullet Train might limp to $100 million, which would be a little bit disappointing, I think. Nope performed notably worse than Jordan Peele's two previous pictures. And family movies like League of Super Pets and Lightyear were super soft. Peter, what is your big takeaway from this last summer box office weekend, but really the whole summer in general?
So I think what we learned this summer was that people are ready to come back to movie theaters, but they're not ready to come back on a regular basis for just any old movie. They're ready to come back when a movie demands to be seen on a big screen. And Top Gun Maverick is the clearest example of that. Lots of people were happy to see that. People saw that many times, right? Like that was a repeat draw for a lot of people. I mean, just anecdotally, you find a lot of those stories, but you can also see it in the numbers. Movies don't perform this well domestically without repeat business. People liked the big screenness of it, and they liked that experience. But people don't seem to be all that interested in coming back for original non-IP films that don't have some sort of big spectacle attached to them, right? And so one reason that you might speculate that Elvis is, so far it is the best non-IP film of the year, unless you consider Elvis the IP. And there is like a whole Hollywood history there, but I think we're going to go ahead and call it an original film for the purposes of this discussion, even though there's obviously like people know who Elvis is. Elvis was, in fact, a spectacle. Like, it was a truly incredible big screen experience. Baz Luhrmann did not just sort of give us another kind of, you know, standard biopic. It has some of those notes, for sure. But that is a movie that really wants to draw you in into an immersive big screen theatrical experience. I think more than a lot of the other films that, you know, in that sort of 10 to 20 slot where we start to see some of the original films show up. But after a couple of years of people not really going to the movies, 2020, you know, basically, for all practical purposes, we can say that the box office did not exist. Yes, obviously, that is an exaggeration. And then in 2021, it was a slow return. What happened over those 2 years was that people learned to be comfortable watching a lot of stuff at home. And so it effectively raised the cost of going out to the theater for them, right? And it's because the home experience, it got better in terms of more people bought big TVs and surround sound systems, that people got more comfortable with it. There were a lot more streaming services either debuted or expanded during that period of time. And so to get people out, it needs to be Hollywood needs to produce really big experiences. And I think it's good news that people are willing to come back, but I also think it is an ominous sign for the future of the industry if certainly one like Nope is struggling a little bit, but if they're not able to sell anything that people don't already know about in some sense. Because at some point you have to be able to produce more movies that aren't just sort of like yet another, Toy Story film, yet another Batman movie, yet another Marvel film, yet another Jurassic Park. And Hollywood does not seem to have any reliable way to produce new properties that are going to keep drawing people 5 or 10 years from now if this sort of behavior persists.
Yeah, I mean, Alyssa, I was gonna ask for your take on that, because it does feel like there was one movie that tried to do that this year. I feel like Bullet Train was a legit attempt to do that sort of thing, create a new John Wick style franchise. But it definitely feels like there is a little bit of creative exhaustion.
Yeah, I think that's right. The other thing I would say about this summer is that the movies aren't just contending with COVID. They're competing with every other aspect of life this summer, right? I mean, this is the first summer, if you have really young kids, as Sunny and I do, that it was possible for your kids to be vaccinated, right? This is the summer that, hot vax summer of 2021 aside, a lot of people have reached the mental point of seeing the pandemic as endemic and are catching up on family travel, on going back to concerts and music festivals and everything else. And so, I don't think it's necessarily a great sign for movies that they were not like the number one thing on a lot of people's to-do lists. But I think this is not a summer that I'm taking as, an indicator of what a guaranteed new future is going to look like, if only because I think the movies are competing with so much of a resurgence of normal life and people feeling like they have to make up for lost time. And so and we're also still dealing with the COVID production bottlenecks to a certain point. I am willing to give it another couple of years before I say definitively, like, this is what the new normal is. So I think this year was always going to be a little weird. But yeah, it's a little worrisome. And, beyond the question of setting up new franchises, like, it would be nice if people could make just like pure one-off movies that people seemed interested in seeing. And I think advertising is still a little weird, in part because so much else is strange in the entertainment ecosystem, right? I mean, I think once Netflix has its advertising business set up, you may see more advertising for theatrical movies there and stuff. But,
Do we think that like Warner Brothers and Disney are going to advertise for Batman and the new Fantastic Four film on Netflix?
Is Netflix going to take that advertising? I don't know. Once the subscription tiers for some of the stuff get opened up, then there'll be some more advertising opportunities somewhere in there, right? I mean, because as it is, like Netflix, even if Netflix just advertised some of its own originals more, they might like beyond just sort of the home screen, even if it was just serving that stuff to Netflix, subscribers already, there would be more of that. Disney will, once it rolls out its ad tier, will be advertising its own stuff. But, linear television in trouble. NBC is talking about cutting an hour of primetime, which is, a radical retrenchment in a lot of ways. The advertising spends are janky. The places where you could advertise are in trouble themselves in some ways. And so I think we have to see how that shakes out. I mean, I think we all saw a lot of ads for Elvis earlier in the year, but the movie we're going to discuss this week, 3,000 Years of Longing, I don't think I saw an ad for it anywhere.
Oh, see, I felt like at least a dozen trailers for this just by going to the movies, you know, and sometimes paying for regular movies.
Yeah, no, I saw, so I mentioned this on Twitter, but I must have seen that trailer 15 times. And it was interesting because I do think, I read somewhere that the movie overperformed in Alamo draft houses, which made me wonder if there was like a... If they had some sort of, I don't know, advertising arrangement with Alamo. Because I saw it in front of literally every PG-13 or higher movie that
I saw. I'm pretty sure I also saw advertisements for it on at least one social media network. Maybe it was, whether it was Instagram or Twitter, I do not recall. But possibly both of them. I'm pretty sure social media was serving me ads for this. And but your point about advertising is interesting because social media is where... Like is where so much of sort of media eyeball time is being spent, and you can advertise to people there, but it's not. It's like sort of strange. We don't talk about TikTok very much on this show, but it's sort of strange that there is a whole generation of kids who make movies. Like that's what they're doing, right? They're making, in some cases, it's just a 60-second little short film, and it's, you know, maybe it's pretty janky. It's made on their iPhone. Maybe the production values are actually kind of surprisingly clever for what they're able to do at home with, you know, a single light kit and a smartphone. But there's a whole generation of kids who like speak in the language of highly edited video, and they don't seem to be going to the movies very much.
Yeah. But to get back to your point about social media, I see stuff, I think, a little less exclusively in draft houses than you guys do. I mean, I have a season pass, but sometimes just in terms of my childcare schedule and proximity, there are a couple of other theaters where I see a lot of stuff, including my local independent theater. And, you know, from a just mere taste perspective, I am probably the most of the three of us, like I'm the person at whom 3,000 Years of Longing is probably most targeted, not because we all like George Miller movies, we all like Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba. I, unlike the two of you, really, really like A.S. Byatt, who wrote the short story on which this is based, and like have a real thing for her like weird, moody novels about academics. And I don't think I saw a trailer for this at all, despite seeing a couple of movies over the summer in the independent theater where I eventually saw it. I did not get served a single ad for it on social media anywhere. And so, like, you know, it's the thing about social media targeting is if you do it wrong, you may miss the people that, yeah, you know.
That's interesting. That is interesting. I want to jump back to something that you said a little earlier, though, Alyssa, about viewing habits changing and kids and families in particular. So the reason I bring this up is because, look, I have a 3-year-old and a 7-year-old now, and there were precisely like 3 movies to go see this summer for them.
How many times did you see Minions: Rise of Gru?
There was Lightyear, Minions: Rise of Gru, and League of Super Pets, and I saw Rise of Gru twice, much against, not quite against my will, but like because I just was like out of things to do. But I like that.
Did you
not...
dress up and do the like wear a tie?
Gentle Minions, yes, that was me. I started the Gentle Minions
trend. Think it was insane that DC didn't do a summer re-release of Encanto. That would have done bonkers business.
Yeah, Disney should have done that, or I mean, like Turning Red. I don't know, something, literally anything. But like there was just nothing to go see, to the extent that, you know, we talked about this $3 movie day. I was like, okay, well, maybe I'll take the kids. It'll be a nice trip to the theaters. It'll be nice and cheap. There was nothing to see. I'm not going to see League of Super Pets again because it sucked. And I didn't want to go see Rise of Gru again because I don't want to kill myself. So, like, there just was nothing to see. And, that is very frustrating for me as both a parent and somebody who is, like, trying to get my kids into going to the theater. Luckily, they love it because they just sit there and eat popcorn. Popcorn. Everybody loves popcorn.
Because they're your kids.
They do the things that I like to do because they want to please me. It makes me happy. So the best thing about having children is that you can warp them however you
want. But look, definitely part of the box office problem is an inventory problem. You know, the last couple of weeks, we've sort of been scraping together the schedule for this podcast. There has not been a lot that's new. And, you know, it does not seem like the studios have figured out their programming cadence again yet. And if you don't offer a couple of target demographics of people something new every weekend, they're not going to go to the movies every weekend.
At the same time, this fallow period has coincided with actually a pretty heavy release schedule for big budget, quasi-cinematic television with House of the Dragon, the Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power, She-Hulk, and then we've got Star Wars Andor coming out in a very soon here in September. And those are all... House of the Dragon obviously does not have like a movie that is associated with it, but it but Game of Thrones helped define the idea of cinematic television. She-Hulk is tied to the Marvel movie universe. Star Wars is tied to the Marvel movie universe. The Lord of the Rings is kind of sorta right tied to the Peter Jackson trilogies. They're sort of cinematically tied in, all of those. And that's a bunch of stuff for people to be watching at home. And so this is one of the ways that the fact that television series are better, more plentiful, more cinematic, more available, you know, cheaper for people to access, means that effectively the cost has been raised for them to go out, right? And I think we are seeing that during these, you know, sort of during these weaker release periods where, of course, people aren't going to go see movies when they've got stuff that if you had released something like this weekend's episode of House of the Dragon in movie theaters 15 years ago, people would have said, wow, that's a pretty stunning fantasy production. I think even as late as like 2009, 2010, people would have thought of that as like, that's the kind of thing you can't do on television.
Yep, and now you can. And one thing I think is smart, and I'm not just saying this because I'm a wholly owned subsidiary of Jeff Bezos, is that, you know, Amazon is doing something intelligent by releasing the Rings of Power episodes on Friday nights, right? They know that HBO owns Sunday nights. But also, you know, if you can make that the Friday night event instead of people going out to theaters, you know, again, that regular release cadence, which Netflix hasn't done, but which every other streaming service has recognized is essential to keeping a conversation going and growing a fandom in a community. And then doing it as Friday night event programming, when you have something that is blockbuster scale and looks, you know, but looks good on your TV, but that demands your full attention and feels like an event, that's really smart, you know, and that's... It makes sense that if Amazon is going to spend like umpty billion dollars, or anyone's going to spend like a quarter of a million, $200 million, running up to now apparently like $1 billion on a television production,
$7 trillion a season,
that they would try to capture that, you know, event night viewing.
The shorter release windows have also played into this, and I think in some ways the most emblematic disappointment at the box office for me this year was Michael Bay's Ambulance. Like, Michael Bay should be able to put together a movie and make $100 million basically anytime he puts out something because it's a Michael Bay movie, right? Like, I'm not saying that it has always happened, but he's the kind of filmmaker who, like, should just draw people, should just draw people in because he makes populist, like, accessible genre films. Yes, you are, Sonny, I can see you, like, right now, you're Googling some box office numbers, and he doesn't always do, his movies don't always perform when they're not Transformers films. At the same time, he is making the kind of, like, this is not an art film, unless you want to, like, argue that his angles, like, you know, his weird angles and, like, choppy editing make him an art film. He's making big, like, cuss word laden, bloody kind of frantic action movies. They're a little arty in the way that they sort of go full on with like the blunderized editing. But like nobody saw Ambulance. I didn't even see Ambulance in the theater, and I wanted to. And I was just like, you know what? This thing's coming to streaming in 6 weeks, and I watched it at home on my OLED, and it was pretty good on the OLED. But that's the sort of movie that we are just not going to see made anymore, because if even I don't get out to a theater to see it, there's not going to be any call for that sort of thing to be made. And Michael Bay is going to end up just making Transformers, you know, 6 through 19 here instead.
Yeah, I just want to, Peter was right. I was pulling up the Michael Bay page on thenumbers.com. And for the record, the last time he had a non-Transformers movie gross more than $100 million domestically at the box office was Bad Boys 2. The last original he had grossed more than $100 million non-franchise was Pearl Harbor. And Bad Boys 2 came out in 2003. Pearl Harbor came out in 2001. So, I mean, like, I mean, I love Michael Bay. Don't get me wrong.
I'm a creature of the 90s, Sonny. It's always 1998 in my head.
Michael Bay, who I love and think is one of America's great filmmakers, truly one of America's great artists of all time. Like all challenging artists, he has not found the mainstream acceptance that he deserves. All right, we're running along here, so let's cut to the question. So what do we think? Is summer 2022 a net win or a net loss for the studios and the Hollywood entertainment industrial complex writ large? Peter?
I think it's a net win for Tom Cruise and a net loss for the Hollywood writ large.
I think it's a sort of chaotic neutral. We're moving into a new normal and we don't know what it's going to be yet.
Ooh, chaotic neutral. I like that. I would say it's a net win, but as Peter hints, I mean, the Hollywood in general owes a great debt of gratitude for Tom Cruise and Top Gun Maverick, not only because it grossed an enormous amount of money. Obviously that's big, not just because Tom Cruise, you know, fought tooth and nail to keep it off of Paramount Plus. And keep it in theaters. He knew what they had. But because it really did spark it reminded people that going to the theaters is fun, and also like soothed, I think, a lot of older audiences who had stayed away for reasons of COVID and other concerns. They came back to the theaters in droves. For that, and started showing up for other things like Elvis. So that was a huge thing. Tom Cruise is the big winner of the summer. All right, make sure to tune in for our bonus episode on Friday, in which we are discussing the careers of two of our most interesting actors, Idris Elba and Tilda Swinton, speaking of whom, on to the main event. 3,000 Years of Longing, George Miller's first film since Mad Max Fury Road, is... I would say it's not one of the summer's winners, in terms of pure box office, dropping out of the top 10 in its second weekend after a mildly disastrous $2.9 million opening weekend. There are questions of advertising. We discussed that before. Folks didn't show up for it, which is too bad because I like this movie. We're not here to talk business. We're here to review it to see if you should go see it or not, humble listener. And the answer to that question is, maybe. Kind of depends on if you can get on the picture's vibes, because this is a very specific sort of movie. It's a story about stories and the power of stories, which puts it just a hair off of being a movie about movies. And I know how folks feel about movies, a little bit self-indulgent maybe, but, you know, still, I like it in a very specific, and it's working in a very specific sort of genre, which we could describe, I think, accurately as magical realism, right? It's a bit like Time Bandits or The Neverending Story, but for adults. Definitely for adults. Do not take your kids to see this movie. Tilda Swinton plays Alethea Binney, a narratologist who is seeing things. Little men in the airport, men in turbans shouting rubbish at her when she suggests that science is replacing myth as the way we order our experience of the universe. While in Turkey, she finds a bottle. In the bottle is a djinn. The djinn is played by Idris Elba. The djinn tells Alethea a series of stories. Stories about desire, about the need we have to be with other people, in the hopes of inspiring her to make the three wishes that will free him from his imprisonment. Alethea, the narratologist, understands that all wish narratives are about the dangers of getting what you wish for, so she is hesitant. Can her postmodern sensibilities and meta-awareness of how storytelling works overwhelm the feeling of sad loneliness that is at the center of her heart? Because in the end, Alethea reminds me, weirdly, of Neil McCauley, Robert De Niro's Master Thief in Heat. He says, at one point in that film, I am alone, I am not lonely. But that is a lie. It's a lie, and he knows it's a lie, and Alethea knows it's a lie when she says she is happy on her own, that she's okay with her former husband being reduced to a box of possessions in the basement. People need people, as we see through the stories the djinn tells us. Look, again, movie's not going to be for everybody. You have to have a high tolerance for stuff like harps that play themselves and discursive meta-narratives, right? I quite liked it, however. I liked the fantasia of it all. I liked the story about storiness of it all. As somebody who kind of works through why stories work and why they don't in my day job, it's always fun to watch something like that play out on screen. And magical realism is a weird thing for me. I don't love it in narrative. I don't love it in narrative prose, right? Like the novels of Salman Rushdie, for instance, we've discussed on the show. They're generally not for me, even though I like his memoirs and his essays, because I don't love reading that sort of thing. But I've always loved it on the screen. I've always loved it in film. Again, Time Bandits and The Neverending Story, among my very first cinematic memories, they've kind of shaped how I watch and experience and enjoy movies. So, again, this movie is for me. I quite liked it. Alyssa, were you able to get on the vibe level? Were the vibes good for you is what I'm asking.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of movie is just extremely, extremely my jam on multiple levels, right? It's two extremely talented, attractive, grown-up actors just sort of being in a room talking to each other. It's a movie about sort of the sensuality and ravishment, both sort of, physical and intellectual and emotional. And it, is about the characters both experiencing those emotions and, providing you with images that just kind of sweep you up in that. And it is, it's the kind of movie that makes me think about what I love about the movie business, which is that, as much expensive, deadening garbage as it produces, people just take wild gambles on stuff like this. And it is delightful that they do. The world is a better place for people, letting George Miller spend tens of millions of dollars adapting an A.S. Byatt short story that I think any sensible analyst could have seen as like probably not going to be a big hit, right? And a business that preserves space for those risks and flights of fancy is just a marvelous thing. And yeah, I mean, I think this movie works because Swinton and Elba are both great, as they typically are, and they're great together, right? Both of them are often play like very controlled characters who break at some point. And, with Swinton, she often plays characters who are not real attractive people on some level, right? They are reptilian, they're amoral, they are, the enforcers of terrible corporate or political regimes.
I feel like that was all just a description of Michael Clayton, for the record.
Also Snowpiercer.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair.
But here, watching her be this sort of repressed person who just like lets out this, sensual, delighted side of herself is so much fun. And, again, Idris Elba is a character who, because he is a large, dark-skinned man, is often cast playing these, sort of threatening, physically dominant characters. For him to play a character who is both physically large but so exquisitely vulnerable and at the, sort of at the whims of other people, but who has such wonderful capacity for delight, is just lovely to watch, right? I mean, it is sort of a Shonda on the movie industry that it has not found recurrent space for Idris Elba to play a romantic lead and a lover, because he is, he is really devastatingly charming and seductive. And, watching him get to play in that mode opposite Swinton is just, it's delightful, right? It's just, it's an outstanding use of two remarkably talented people, one of whom in particular is, really has been allowed to play sort of a fraction of his range throughout his American career.
Peter, what did you make of 3,000 Years of Longing?
Oh, I loved it. It's romantic and magical and earnest without being saccharine, which is pretty rare and difficult to pull off. It's what Alyssa said. It's a movie about loneliness and connection, right? And but also about, it's a movie about stories, but it's also a movie about the relationship between stories and science and the ways that both stories and science are explanations for the phenomena that we see in the world around us. But that, it's ultimately science can, and it sort of makes this argument that science can tell us a lot, that it can tell us what a star is made of and that it can, help us travel across continents on airplanes and make phone calls, through the air. But there is some limitation to what science can do in this movie's worldview. What science cannot do is it can't explain the yearnings and the feelings that's tug at people's hearts. And so this is a movie that is that does an interesting job. It's something interesting, which is that it seems it's very comfortable with the idea of science and with the idea of sort of technological explanations for things. It's not one that is that sort of attempts to dismiss that way of looking at the world. It just wants to say there's another way. There's more to it than that. And if you're only a world that is bound entirely by scientific explanations, by physical forces that can be mapped and, you know, charted and graphed and measured, that world lacks something. And that something is hard to describe, but we all know what it is because it's within every person, even someone like Tilda Swinton's character who claims to not need anything else, who claims to sort of have, who thinks of herself as being compact and sort of all together already. Even someone like that longs for something herself, even if she doesn't admit it. And that's it's a very nice idea for a movie, and it's just incredibly well executed. And obviously, like, it's just such a technical pleasure to watch, right? And a movie like this, which is in part about the pleasures of being a human and about the pleasure of the sensations that people can, you know, can experience, that movie needs to sell those pleasures. And this movie does such a good job of that, right? Just it is itself like a decadent pleasure to experience, and so much, so, you know, there's a lot of CG in this movie, and people, like, you know, even on this podcast, we just talk about how bad CG is, and you know, just sort of computer, very expensive computer graphics can look terrible in Hollywood, and this is not a cheap movie by any means. The budget is reportedly around $60 million, but it's not super expensive, right? This is not a $200 million Marvel film, and yet both the execution of the CG, just sort of on like how good does this look, but also the imagination behind it puts so much else to shame, right? And you watch this movie and you think about, like, here's what a talented filmmaker can get onto the screen. And it really makes you think, ah, we're just missing so much, even in a Hollywood that is kind of nominally dedicated to showing us elaborate imaginary worlds and spaces. This is what like real imagination looks like in high tech cinema in 2022.
Well, and it's a good movie for talking about, like, what is your CGI for, right? Because if it is to deliver just like a hyper realistic sort of like a photorealistic, set of images of something that couldn't exist in the real world or couldn't be brought to life in the real world in a practical way cheaply, that's only one of its uses, right? I mean, but part of what is fascinating about the CGI here is that it is used to suggest things sort of at the edge of your perception, right? Things that are not actually stable or crisp or clear, in the sort of, you know, distorted way that the djinn's body sort of emerges into the hotel room with, you know, with like toes sticking around corners. It suggests sort of mutability, insubstantiality, and things that are, you know, sort of slightly beyond human, the limits of human perception because they're so new, right? It's like, and in some ways, the weaknesses of CGI for, you know, recreating things that don't, or creating things that don't actually exist, are treated here as a potential advantage, right? They, Miller sort of specifically doesn't use CGI only to create, you know, photorealistic simulacra of worlds, but rather a feeling of touching something and being in contact with something that is not quite explicable, right? And that is, you know, like sexy and alluring and tempting precisely because it is not quite as explicit and crisp.
Well, and I, speaking of what CGI is for, I mean, in this movie, when something doesn't quite look realistic, it's fine because it's not realistic. I mean, like, this is very specifically going for a sort of fantastic sensibility, which in turn excuses things that don't look real because they're not supposed to look real. I mean, like it is very much within itself a fantasy and a fantastic retelling of these stories, which is in a way very refreshing. I mean, I don't need to see any more real fake dinosaurs.
Yeah, it's just it recognizes that enchantment isn't always about selling you the idea that something is fake, that is fake is real, right? It's about suspending the need to differentiate between fake and real, because there is so much charm and pleasure involved in the illusion.
So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on 3,000 Years of Longing? Alyssa?
Thumbs up. Great, like, grown-up date movie. Awesome.
Peter?
Big thumbs up. Love George Miller. It's just a wonderful movie.
Thumbs up. I have a feeling. I said this at the time. I saw this trailer about 20 times in theaters, at least. And every time I saw it, I was like, "That looks very interesting." Nobody is going to go see it in theaters. It is not the sort of movie that is an easy sell. It looks a little bit weird, and it looks a little bit extravagant. And you know, people will probably not show up for it. But I do think it has the possibility of becoming a cult favorite as the years go along. I feel like this is the sort of movie that people will discover and enjoy and make a treasured part of their 4K Blu-ray disc collection in their house, on their walls, where all their great stuff lives. All right. That is it for this week's show. Make sure to swing by atma.thebulwark.com for a bonus episode on Friday. I promise to upload the actual bonus episode this week instead of an episode from another podcast, as I did last week for about 10 minutes. I'm very sorry for that if you were a little bit freaked out by the non-ATMA episode in your feed, but that's okay. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.